Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franson and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
Well, we're both happy to be together again with you, Mike Murphy. Hi, Gina. Once again, we're starting with the weather, but this won't be about snowdrifts and slick roads. It'll be about what we can expect in the future.
Weather prediction of the future.
Well, let's start with the weather in Texas. Back in 2014, when Alma Taylor first told us about the polar vortex, we were on the southern edge of this phenomenon of polar air dipping down into the Midwest. Well, this year, the news reports that it has dipped down into Texas, and we've seen several articles with warnings about the grid. So I was fortunate to find James McCauley, distinguished professor at ISU in electrical and computer engineering. Welcome, Professor McCauley. Let's start with the basics. Could you tell us something about how the nation is divided into grids and why the situation in Texas is so dire?
Yeah, thank you, Susan. It's nice to be here. Very glad to have this opportunity to talk to you. But yeah, there's three interconnections, we call them, in the United States. You can think of it, one in the east, one in the west, and one in Texas. And the one in Texas we refer to as the ERCOT interconnection. It stands for Electric Reliability Council of Texas. These three interconnections operate mainly independently, it's been that way for many years. The Eastern interconnection, of which Iowa is a part, is by far the largest, with something on the order of about 700 gigawatts of generating capacity. The Western interconnection is second, with about 265 gigawatts of generation capacity, so less than half of the East. And then Texas has a bit over 80 gigawatts of generating capacity, just to give you a little bit of an idea of the size. So that's just a quick overview of the different grids in the U.S. that we use. To address the second part of your question in regards to what's happened in Texas recently, the bottom line is they have experienced a weather event that was extreme, unique, something that they have not seen before, with temperatures nearing 0 degrees. In Iowa, this is quite common. In Texas, it's obviously very, very unique to see that kind of weather. And because, for one reason, they weren't prepared for that kind of weather, they've had some troubles with failures of generation facilities. Also, another important influence was the type of generation that they use in Texas is heavily natural gas. So simultaneous with failures in power plants, you had extreme demand on the supply, not only from electric, but also from heating. And then the third major issue there with ERCOT is that they do operate their state pretty much independent, as I mentioned, of other resources, of other states' resources. And so when they do get in trouble, they are not able to call on assistance from their neighbors. So that has been also an influencing factor to the situation that they have there today, or have had there in the past week. I think they're pretty close to back now in terms of supplying all of the electrical needs of the people that are there, but there's still a lot of residual impacts.
Well, I read that a lot of this is because they're so tied to the, not the natural gas, but the petroleum infrastructure, which they're, of course, they're a big oil state. And they've made, of course, some very significant derogatory statements, particularly about renewables, wind and solar. And they sound pretty strange to us. Why do they have trouble with their windmills? We don't have trouble with ours. Why? What do we do to ours?
So I've also heard some of the comments made coming from individuals in the state government of Texas about the influence of renewables on the situation that they had. I don't know why people are making such statements. I disagree. I don't think they're wind or solar are had a very significant influence on the state of their situation. Their wind turbines, some of them did fail. A little bit of their solar capacity also failed, but the primary failure was in the what we refer to as is the thermal fleet. The thermal fleet is coal, natural gas, and nuclear. So the primary failures of the Texas grid over the past week were in those three areas. But it is true that there were some failures in the wind turbines, the wind farms as well. And the primary reason for that was because their wind turbines are not weatherized. They were not prepared for the kind of weather that they had. In Iowa, it's quite different. We see that kind of weather all the time. Our wind fleet is fully capable of operating at 0 degree weather or even, you know, minus 10 very effectively.
Thank you very much. We don't have to worry about that kind of problem, but what's our connection to the grid? I've read a lot in the paper about we should have a national grid and things like this. Would that even be possible?
Yeah, so the grid plays a huge role in our energy provision in our society. So when we say grid, of course, we think about the generation resources, and we also think about the transmission facilities that move large quantities of power from where they're generated to the load centers where they're consumed. And then we also think about the distribution grid, which is different than the transmission grid. The distribution grid is the lower voltage, lower capacity lines that you see running down your street. These are the three primary features of what we refer to as the grid, and it is essential to how we live today. In Iowa, we're part of a regional operation called MISO. In such an organization, we are interconnected to other states in the Western region, and we share resources with other states in our region, Minnesota, Kansas, Oklahoma, Illinois, and so forth. All of these are in the MISO region. So it's very useful to be able to share resources. But for many, many different reasons, the primary one is because it's most economic to be able to share resources. We're able to save a lot of money by providing resources to states when they need it, and to use the resources of other states when we need it. So that's a function of our grid, and really useful under normal operations. We do it every day, 24/7, the sharing of resources and energy and capacity and grid services. It's also extremely useful to do when you have severe events. And as much as we'd like to think we're immune from such, every place in the U.S., every place in the world is subject to such kinds of events. It might not be cold weather, it might be hot weather, it might be hurricanes, it might be tornadoes, earthquakes, or in our case, derechos, right? Floods. So there's many, many different reasons why you can have a severe event that causes problems in the grid. And when you do, it's extremely useful to be able to reach out and seek assistance and receive assistance from your neighbor. That's what the interconnection is all about. It enhances and improves the economics of energy supply, as well as the reliability of energy supply. And we use it 24/7 very heavily It's not something new. We've been doing it for many, many decades now.
Something else that I read about was if we increased the number of electric cars drastically, so that the proportion of the electric cars would went up to, we'll say, 75% or something, or even 100%, that this would be too much for our grid. Or our, I guess not a distribution so much as just the generation capacity.
So that's a great thought, a great point to raise here in our conversation, and that is, I would refer to that as electrification. Right now, the energy use for all possible, all thinkable services in the U.S. Comes about 70% from either electricity or transportation related. It's about seven, so it's only 30% remaining, and of that 30% is mainly heating or industrial commercial uses. So 70% of all energy use is either through the electric grid or it's through the gas pump, petroleum based. And so when you think about the future and reducing carbon emissions, the strategy is fairly simple. You build low CO2 emitting resources on the electric side, and you electrify the transportation side. It's a very simple formula in a way, and that's what the community is all about. In building in wind and solar, and of course we have hydroelectric, and there's other renewables as well, in order to reduce the fossil part of our electric fleet, so that then we can increase the loading to compensate for the electrification of the transportation services that we have. Right, so I own two electric vehicles. Not many people do, but as we go forward in time, you're right, we can certainly expect a transformation from heavily petroleum-based transportation system to hopefully a highly electrically supplied transportation system. And obviously, you're going to have to increase the electric capacity to do that. If you increase the electric capacity through fossil fuels, it does no good. So it's necessarily the case that you, in order to make that a reasonable strategy, that you would increase the capacity in the electric side through renewables of one kind or another.
Surprisingly, in Iowa, we think about electric cars. We don't very often think about electric heat. I know my husband has said, we couldn't live in Iowa without natural gas. So what would be involved in switching to electric for all home heating?
So that would be another dimension to the electrification, and certainly it's thinkable. And some of these things, you know, may eventually happen, but there certainly will also be a transition period. Natural gas is certainly a fossil fuel, and it is a CO2 emitter, but compared to its sister, coal, it's a significantly lower CO2 emitter on a per energy unit basis. So for every unit of energy you get from natural gas compared to a unit of energy you get from coal, coal's about double the CO2 emissions. And so natural gas certainly is something that, you know, eventually we need to move away from, but the community thinks of it as it's a very good transition fuel. As we make this transition from heavy fossil to heavy renewables, that natural gas provides us with some flexibility. So the extent that we want to move natural gas out of the heating side of our economy, so to speak, there's a lot of discussion there. It's not quite clear that we want to move too fast in that direction yet, since we have these other arenas to work on, one being electric production and the other being transportation.
Well, thank you very much. This is a pretty thorough beginning lesson in electricity. You did mention something the other day. But the first time I ever heard of the grid was when they were talking about building, power lines to export wind energy, because we produce so much wind energy, and the companies that build those windmills would like to be able to sell more of it. What's the distribution issue here? Is there any way to avoid these big power lines going across the state?
Yeah, well, so that's a great question, and the thought starts, you know, from really understanding what does it take to transition our electric generation fleet from where it is today to a highly renewable fleet. Nationally we use fossil fuels to supply electricity for about 60% of our energy today. So fossil fuels are still huge. So if you want to really move and make this transition, we probably need to triple or quadruple our renewable fleet. And I say renewable, that means wind, solar, hydro, probably geothermal has a role to play here, maybe a little biomass, but certainly wind, solar. And if you want to reach out to Canada, then you might be able to do more hydro as well. So at those levels, this is amazingly large changes in our generation infrastructure, and it's not going to happen in a year. This is a 10, 15, 20, maybe longer time period of transition. At those levels, you have to build a lot more generation resources, in especially wind and solar. So if you look at the places where wind and solar are really inexpensive to build, meaning their resources are rich. Iowa is certainly a leader there, very strong wind resources in our state. That's why we have 10.5 gigawatts of wind capacity today in Iowa, second in the nation, second only to Texas. We could double that. We could potentially triple that. And if you think in those terms, then the current transmission infrastructure is insufficient to handle that level of additional capacity in wind in our state. And generally, the other areas around the country that are rich in wind resources or solar resources, it's the same way. The system was built for a different kind of generation fleet, the transmission was. And so if you're going to make this kind of transformation, you really need to build in more transmission all over the country. So there's been a lot of discussion over the past 5-10 years on building what we refer to as a macro grid. So first of all, there's different ways to build out your transmission. You can do so incrementally on a project by project basis, or you can do so in a very kind of large, significant way, much like we did when we built the interstate highway system in the 1960s and 1970s, right? We had a bunch of two-lane roads all over the country. And within 15, 20 years, the Eisenhower administration started this. We built our I-80s and our I-35s and I-75s and so forth, those interstate highways that we love to, you know, drive on now. It's much like that. We currently have an interconnected grid throughout the country, but they're two-lane roads in a sense. We don't have an interstate highway system at the grid level. So the thinking is, if we did, it would greatly facilitate our ability to build resources where the best resources tend to be where people don't live so much. Population densities are low, so that we can move those resources into the high use load centers. So this has been a current level of thinking that really has sort of excited a lot of people as a primary way to facilitate the growth of renewables in the country. And so the kind of example that I used with respect to the interstate highway system is probably reasonable. You can think of three or four, maybe five east-west major paths and three or four or five major north-south paths with high capacity direct current transmission, bringing the energy from you know, places like the Midwest, places like offshore East Coast, places like the Southwest Desert, those resources into the load centers of, you know, Chicago and New York, Boston, Atlanta, Los Angeles, and so forth.
Could I have some question? What's going on in like southern Wyoming? That is a very windy area, and they're taking down all kinds of wind turbines.
It's an interesting question. I'm not aware that they're removing or reducing their wind fleet. Wyoming is a good wind state, and has been. They've been building that resource for a little while. It's an interesting state in that it is also a huge coal reservoir state. One of the most important coal reservoirs in the country is in Wyoming, and so you get, you know, kind of those, both of those interests there. So I'm sorry, Gina, I don't know about any situation in Wyoming where they are reducing their wind fleet. I know of several projects where they're growing their wind fleet, but you'd have to educate me there on that particular issue.
Okay. And I had another question. How do you foresee, I know several years ago they were doing research on wind turbines to be on like the top of roof homes and or individual wind mills at homes that could generate electricity for individual homes. What do you see as the future of those, or kind of where's the research at with those?
So we refer to that as distributed wind as a form of a larger category of resources called distributed energy resources. So certainly solar panels on your roof would fall into a form of distributed energy resources, but a wind turbine, you know, in somebody's backyard, so to speak, would also fall into that kind of category. We don't have very much distributed wind. Maybe the largest reason is because, you know, wind turbines, of course, need height, right? They need to get elevated in order to capture that good wind. You know, 100 meter turbines are typical on the large wind farms. So to make it economically attractive, you need that height, and typically, you know, our residential homes and so forth are in fairly dense urban areas, and so there's restrictions on what kind of height you can get at. And so, from a wind point of view, in an urbanized area, it's a little bit difficult. On buildings, there's some good research going on right now, and it may be that, you know, you can build in different kinds of wind technologies in high-rise buildings going forward, and that's a thought. But these are probably, relatively speaking, incremental contributors to our overall energy needs. The main contributors probably are going to come through, you know, we refer to it as the utility scale forms of wind and solar resources. Solar may be a bit different, and maybe Steve can speak to this better. But solar, of course, you have the ability to put those panels on your roof, and in some cases, you know, that can be economically attractive way to go. But distributed wind, the acreages and rural areas, you might think of doing that, and people are and have been for years. And there, it may look a little better economically, but in most towns and so forth, it's a hard sell today. We'll see where we go in the future, though. Good question. Well,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is really an energy show, and we have another guest who actually originally came to us because we were talking about some legislation, and so that's obviously a big thing right now, that we want to make people aware of what legislation they need to watch. And so I will, in case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been talking with Professor James McCauley about the electrical grid and some of the issues with energy generation and distribution. Our next guest is Steve Geyer, who is Energy and Climate Policy Specialist for the Iowa Environmental Council. And he is here to make us aware of decisions being made at the Iowa legislature. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Susan. Glad to be here. I'll take the first opportunity, since you sort of led into it in terms of what we originally were going to talk about, which is, it's referred to as House File 221. It is a bill to do several things with the solar tax credit. So we have a tax credit in Iowa for solar, but if we don't take action, because of the way the current law is coupled to the federal law, it will actually disappear at the end of this year. So this bill will decouple it from the federal legislation. It will become a separate credit, no longer with the feds. It will basically double the amount per year from $5 million to $10 million. It will basically put it at 15% of whatever you spend, and then it will cap residential at $5,000, commercial at $20,000. And I think importantly, this has been an extremely successful program in Iowa. For about every dollar that the state has invested in the tax credit, we've seen $7 worth of investment in the state. And as a result of how successful it is, there's currently a backlog of individuals that have been waiting for their credit, but the funding has not been there. So the bill will also take care of that by doing a one-time, approximately $7, maybe $8 million appropriation to take care of that backlog. So that's where we are going to start. Certainly like to talk about the items that Jim is talking about also. But as you know, I'm going to make a pitch here for something occurring tomorrow. And it is our Environmental Advocacy Day. It is free to attend. It is virtual this year. So anybody is able to attend it. It'll be from 12 to 3. Just go to iaenvironment.org and you'll be able to register for it. We'll see legislators and environmental advocates talking. We'll have 20 organizations and businesses that are exhibiting virtually. So you'll be able to ask them questions. So certainly encourage you. There will also be breakouts where we'll have a breakout in clean energy, water. There will be a opportunity to learn how to advocate. There will be an opportunity to learn how to write op-eds and basically letters to the editor. So encourage all of that.
Well, that's on the way to increasing our use of the grid, right?
It is. And so I'll sort of pick up a little bit on sort of where Jim was talking as far as transmission. Our transmission planning occurs at MISO. And so although we currently have sufficient transmission, we don't have transmission to basically accommodate anything additional. So we recognize we're going to have additional generation coming online, but it's an extremely long process. The process that is just finishing up now, which was called their multi-value project, put in a number of lines, but it took well over 10 years. And in fact, the last line of that project, although it's been approved, Wisconsin is actually fighting that. So it's a very long process, long planning process. And I think what it comes down to, not only from the aspect of the expense of the projects, but also, as you're aware, these lines face, I'll just say, pretty constant, issues in terms of people just not wanting to see them.
Can't some of them be buried?
That's a good point. In fact, that sort of certainly ties in with some of the aspects of what we saw this week down in Texas, where although companies don't like to bury them because it's more expensive, it really has to come down to an analysis as to, well, yes, it's more expensive to build in the original state, but what happens when that line goes down? How many times will you basically have to rebuild that line? The example I used, I think, is in Germany, they've analyzed this. And in many of their lines, they took that risk into account and actually built them underground so that they don't have that same engineering flaw, I'll say. Admittedly, underground lines aren't perfect. They have engineering complexities also, but that takes some of the climate-based risk that we're looking at out of play. Interestingly enough, there's actually a proposed one in Northeast Iowa. It's referred to as the Sioux Green Line. In fact, it'll be unique to Iowa. It'll be underground. It'll be following a railroad right-of-way. And it's high voltage DC, which is a first in terms of the state. And I think actually the technology they're using might be the first example of its use in the U.S. That will also do exactly what we're talking about in terms of its purpose in life is to actually transport the wind energy that we have in Iowa from the MISO market. And their intent is to be able to push it into the PJM market, which is on the East Coast. Those are all things that hope that currently it's a little bit delayed. They're having trouble getting approval from PJM, but those are all examples of things that I think will come.
Iowa, of course, has lots of railroad right-of-ways. They don't always continue on to other states anymore. Is that right or not?
That is right. I mean, certainly, this particular one happens to be on a line that, and as we know, yes, a lot of the lines basically got removed as the railroad companies basically started to deplete or consolidate down to fewer entities. Ultimately, when they don't have, for instance, railroad right-of-ways, which is what this one shows, most states, including Iowa, have language in place where you're required to try and find a path that follows existing right-of-ways so that you're not, for instance, going diagonally across a farm field. So to the best extent they can, that's what they try and do is following existing right-of-ways.
I think from our discussions yesterday, there's a lot more to talk about with where you can put solar farms. And maybe we can do that on another day. This is actually, to my surprise, it's a much, much, much bigger project to talk about than you can do on the radio in half a morning. Just shows how little I knew. So thank you so much for being with us today and sort of opening the box for our possibilities of learning about the future of electricity and renewables in our lives.
Susan, do we have time? Just I want to make one follow-up to something that Jim had or mentioned in terms of what we might see in terms of increases in generation capacity. And so, yes, as we look at what he referred to as electrification, ultimately, the studies that we have looked at suggest that we could see as much as actually 6 times the amount of wind that we have currently and up to 46 gigawatts of solar if we electrify everything and if we basically become a state that exports to other states. Oh, and in case you wondered, yes, there is sufficient land to do that in Iowa.
How are we going to do that is something to learn about in the future. Thanks so much, Steve. We look forward to seeing you again soon. But now it's time to turn to some political issues that are coming up in the next week. So we have to talk about them now. To mark this change, we're going to play a song about change.
Follow the Moskwa down to Gonky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change. That we could be so close, like brothers. The future's in the air, can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today your hosts, Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews, have been talking with James McCallie of the ISU Electrical and Computer Engineering Department, and Steve Geyer, Energy and Climate Policy Specialist, about necessary changes and growth in generation and distribution in our electrical grid. For the balance of our program, we'll turn to big political changes that come from redistricting and new proposed laws that will change the way we vote. Starting with redistricting, we have Evan Berger. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Susan. Great to be back.
Yeah. Well, this was a story that you are the person to talk about it because you wrote an article for the blog Breaking Heartland with lots of great pictures of possible outlines for our future for districts. And so could you explain what this is all about?
Yeah, certainly. So like you said, redistricting, aka the redrawing of all the boundaries of the legislative and congressional and political districts in the state, happens every 10 years. Every state has to redraw these boundaries the year after the census. So of course, we just had the 2020 census, so now we're in 2021. And in a normal year, every state would be going through a process to use that data to redraw their districts. And the reason it's tied to the census, of course, is that there's a constitutional mandate, you know, this kind of one person, one vote idea that districts should be as equal as possible in size, population size. And so as population changes, the district boundaries have to change as well so that districts remain as equal as possible in size. And each state kind of approaches this process a little bit differently. But every state is kind of up in the air right now because the 2020 census had so many problems. You know, obviously it was happening during a pandemic, so that made things a lot harder. But then also President Trump tried to make a lot of changes kind of midstream through the census, and it slowed things down a lot. So there were kind of two big things that were happening with the census, and they added up to a massive delay in the release of the census results that are needed for redistricting. So normally the census census starts releasing the results around this time. So, you know, in the year 2011, in February, Iowa started to get the data from the census about how population had changed, and that allowed us to start our process. This year, the U.S. Census Bureau has said that they're not going to have that data ready until September 30th is their current date that they're aiming for, as opposed to, you know, usually, like I said, around this time, around like February, March. So that's creating a lot of problems for a lot of states, and Iowa is one of them. We have a constitutionally defined timeline for when redistricting has to be wrapped up by September 1st, or else some changes that we can talk about happen. And of course, when you have the data, you don't even get the data until September 30th. You cannot reach that September 1st deadline. There's a lot of uncertainty, and you know, I can say a few words about the process as it it normally functions, if that's helpful.
Actually, I have always understood that Iowa had a pretty good system.
It's very much so. So Iowa is definitely the normal process, or the redistricting process that we have is held up as kind of a gold standard across the country for being nonpartisan and being very fair. And the way the process usually works is it's driven by the Legislative Services Agency, which is a nonpartisan government agency that supports the legislature in all sorts of technical things. And one of the things they do is they kind of drive this redistricting process. So the Legislative Services Agency, aka the LSA, you know, the way the process usually works is the LSA receives the data from the census, like I said, around this time. And then the LSA sits down and they have, you know, these fancy computer models, and they have a lot of expertise and human knowledge. And they sit down and they draw up a proposed map of not just the congressional districts, but all of Iowa's 50 state Senate districts and 100 state House districts. And there are all sorts of rules for how these different kinds of districts interact. But the LSA, you know, like they're experts on this. They drop a proposal and they try and make it as fair as possible, both in terms of population and in terms of what they call compactness. So this is where this compactness idea is really where Iowa's process shines, because when you think about a gerrymandered district, you know, the word gerrymandering comes from a district back in the 19th century that looked like a salamander. You know, it was like this big, long, stretched out, sinuous thing. And you know, a political cartoonist said, oh, this is the salamander that Mayor Gary drew. And I believe it was Boston or something like that. And so when you think about a gerrymandered district, you think about these bizarre shapes, and they stretch, you know, for hundreds of miles or dozens of miles, and they're weird shapes. And Iowa has these compactness rules that say you cannot draw districts like that. You know, you have to make sure that they have as small of a perimeter as possible, and that they're as close to square as possible. And so, you know, the LSA uses that standard, as well as a very strict population equality standard, to draw proposed districts. And then they send those districts to the legislature. The legislature votes that proposed map up or down. They either say, yes, we accept it, or no, we want the LSA to do more work. They send it back to the LSA. Up until the third proposal, the legislature can either vote it up or down. On the third proposal, the legislature can start to make amendments. So they can start to make small tweaks rather than just an up or down vote. But it still has to be based on that map that the LSA provided. And then finally, if they can't come to a conclusion, the Supreme Court steps in and takes over and draws the maps. And that has not happened since this kind of set of rules came into place. The Supreme Court hasn't had to get involved, but because of the deadlines that we're going to miss this year, that might be the case.
It sounds to me that the issues with the census are going to be significant also on the county level. What do you call those? State districts.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. So that census data is the only time that population is counted with enough specificity that the LSA can draw these legislative district maps. And so that's why it's so important. It's not like, you know, the census is late, but we have other data that we can use to draw these maps. No, the census data is the only data that gives you enough information to draw these maps. And again, the LSA uses a very high standard of population equality. And so a difference of even, you know, 10 or 50 people between one town and another is going to result in different proposals from the LSA. So it is very important. And, you know, the fact that it's delayed, again, that September 1st deadline I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court has the authority to step in and just take over the entire map drawing process. And they basically have free reign to come up with whatever maps they want. And that September 1st deadline was put into place to just make sure that the legislature wrapped up this kind of back and forth with the LSA in a timely fashion. And under normal circumstances, that'd be plenty of time, you know, something like 6 months for that negotiation to happen. But, you know, when you don't receive the data until after the deadline, obviously it's impossible to meet. And so, you know, the big question right now, there, like you said, Susan, there's just a ton of uncertainty around the process. The number one biggest question for us here in Iowa is, how does the Supreme Court intend to exercise its authority to take over the map making process on September 15th? Or is it going to give the legislature an extension and say, look, this was out of your control, you know, we're going to let you continue to run the map making process, and just, you know, and then they set a new deadline of like, okay, now just get it done by December 31st or whatever they decide to set. So that's the big question. What's the Supreme Court going to do? And so far they haven't said. So reporters have been asking the Supreme Court, you know, obviously, like, what are your plans? And all the court has said to everyone is just, we cannot comment on future cases. And of course, this isn't a case, you know, this is a constitutional duty that they have to oversee the map making process. And so hopefully, I mean, I think I would really hope that the Supreme Court decides to make their intentions clear, because I don't think it's a good thing for democracy to have this important process kind of shrouded in uncertainty. There, you know, hopefully the Supreme Court is just kind of evaluating its options, and they're going to make an announcement what they intend to do pretty soon. But right for now, they haven't. One thing I'll say is that in California, like I said, every state is dealing with this problem. Every state has to figure out their redistricting under this new, with the census delays. And in California, the legislature requested an extension of their constitutional deadline from the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court unanimously granted it. So one thing that, you know, Republican legislative leadership could do to kind of encourage the Supreme Court to take a stand is they could send a letter saying, look, we can't do, we can't finish the maps in time because of census delays. It's something out of our control. We're requesting an extension to, again, December 15th or something like that. Will you grant it? And then the Supreme Court could respond. So, we'll see how it all plays out. One thing we know for sure is that the legislature will have to come into a special session in October, essentially, to debate all this. That's going to be, it's going to be a weird year. That's the one thing we know for sure, but we don't know exactly in what ways it will be weird.
Well, thank you for helping us go through another complicated issue. And that's not the only one. And this one we will be deciding much sooner. And this is the wording of two bills that have been rushed through legislature. This is two identical bills that got their wording. And they announced last night that these are going to be voted on right away. These bills are called election reform by Republicans, responding to the widespread Republican claims that there was tremendous fraud in the election, and voter suppression by Democrats. In light of the feeling of these names reflect, we asked Carolyn Klaus of the Nonpartisan League of Women Voters to report on the outcome. Thanks for tracking down the report and coming to tell us about it, Carolyn.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me this morning. I went down to the State House in opposition to this voter bill on Monday. The League is in opposition to this on a statewide level. And we were pretty lucky, Susan. We didn't meet yesterday because what happened last night when the news came on, at 10 o'clock, I found out they had voted. The Senate had voted and adopted some changes. We can only hope that when the House gets this bill, that they'll add a few more changes to it. The original bill had a lot of changes in it, and it was not based on any evidence of any fraud or problems in the state of Iowa. There was the biggest discrepancy in Iowa were the three counties that sent out completed absentee ballot request forms, and that disgruntled a lot of people in the state of Iowa that those people were receiving them. So basically, to take control of the absentee ballot request form, the only way you can get one now is to go on your computer and download one. They did allow you to call the auditor's office now and request an absentee ballot request form. It appears, until we see all the wording on it, parties cannot send out. Remember last year you got about 15, 20 absentee ballot request forms? It appears you will not receive any this year or in perpetuity. There will be none mailed to you. You can get one. Somebody can hand you one, or maybe at the Republican or Democratic headquarters, they'll have one that's marked general or primary and the year of the election on it. That's all that can be put on the absentee ballot request form. The other big changes that are different from the original draft, they had requested 18 days early voting. Well, they expanded it to 20 days. So we're now up to 20. So on about probably October 18 or something like that, we can start voting at the auditor's office. So, because the election is November 2nd this fall for the school and the city offices. The other big change was the polls now close at 8 o'clock. I don't have a problem with that. When you start at 7 o'clock in the morning and you arrive at your polling location, I've been a poll worker for many years. I tell you, when it becomes 9 o'clock and you know it's still another hour or more to get the information sent into the auditor's office and cleaned up, you're dragging. So getting to start at 8 o'clock will be good. But I have a feeling what that will do is there'll be lines at 8 o'clock because, you know, mom's got the kitchen cleaned up and dad's reading a book and mom finally gets to vote in the evening and go to the polls. So there'll be lines there. So they had a rule in there that employees, if they have so many hours of working during election day, they used to be able to take 3 hours to go vote. They shortened that to 2 hours. They can request 2 hours. So the changes just go on and on. What bothers me is that Iowa had the 76% of eligible voters in the state of Iowa voted in the 2020 election, and there was no indication of fraud. You know, there was no widespread fraud. And so instead of expanding and making a greater number of people eligible to vote, they've put in all of these new changes and restrictions, and it just makes it more difficult. We have to teach and educate everybody on all these changes. Again, when I spoke on Monday at the hearing, I said, walk in the shoes of a county auditor every time you make these changes. Walk in the shoes of a poll worker who can now be, you're an election official. If you give out incorrect information, there will now be fines of up to $10,240 for county election officials. You've got 10 people maybe in this room giving out information to people coming through the line. I try to never guess on an answer for an election, but boy, you try to get people worked through. So you could, they're another group of people who will be very much at risk. And then there's the people who are working out there to register our students, to make sure people are updated on their registrations, that we educate them. It's going to be very hard to make sure everybody is on the same page. I'm very discouraged, and the House, they say, will probably vote on this next Wednesday. I hope they look at some more changes. I think it's very important that we all stress the changes that we don't want in this bill, and maybe the House will have a little more common sense on what they're doing to people. You know, who's going to pay for all the changes? Well, who's going to volunteer to be an election official?
I think that is a good closing question, and we are closing our hour out. So thank you so much for talking about these important bills, and there's still time, I guess, to contact our legislators.
You've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests are not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Other voices you heard were James McCallie, Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering, Steve Geyer, Energy and Climate Policy Specialist for the Iowa Environmental Council, Evan Berger, partner at Hegemony Strategies, and Carolyn Klaus, representing the Ames League of Women Voters. Our theme song is by Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or you can contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. You can just get on the website and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.